Dire implications of the return of Planet X. Is NASA covering up its existence? And how does biblical and Mayan prophecy describe an event of enormous destructive magnitude for which we need to begin to prepare? Up next, Gilbert Erickson with some answers. The Millennium Prophecy on Coast to Coast AM. Former Vietnam helicopter pilot Gilbert Erickson has had a lifelong interest in figuring out how the world works, and he graduated from Cal State Fullerton with a degree in psychology. Then he went on to do graduate work at the University of Oklahoma. After studying literature, prophecy, the Book of Revelation, Gil began to unravel things on energy systems, free energy, anti-gravity systems, and then finally, the implications of Planet X and how that affects us. Here he is on Coast to Coast, the Millennium Prophecy. Gilbert, how are you?
Good evening, George. How are you doing?
Good. First of all, thank you for serving, by the way.
You're quite welcome. That was that was an exciting time of life.
Oh, my gosh, a long time ago. When you came back, Gil, were you, was it the pomp and circumstance or was it the typical treatment of Vietnam soldiers when they came back?
There was zero pomp. There was zero circumstance. The only people who were grateful were mostly family and friends.
Yeah, I figured that. Oh, well, I'm glad you're here. And tell me a little bit about yourself beyond just what I read with the bio.
Well, let's see. After Vietnam, I decided we'd take a shot at becoming a translator, and I pursued that for a while. That's why the graduate work in descriptive linguistics.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that way was blocked, I was really kind of just lost for direction. So I went back to working mostly, ideas in physics and just kind of a basic existence plus all these various mental challenges. And I pursued the clean energy stuff. Later, the anti-gravity idea started coming in. And I also worked on some of the additional analysis for the Book of Revelation. It was actually Coast to Coast, you people, when you interviewed Jason Rand, The Return mm-hmm. of Planet X, that caught my ear just the very night I heard it. I thought, wait a minute. This is the only one that lines up in tandem, in parallel, with the Revelation, because Revelation describes two sets of basic judgment events, chapter 8 and chapter 16. And his was the only explanation that made any sense at all. I was going to try to explain it like with giant comets or something,
Right.
But the wormwood science is way more scary. And as we got deeper and deeper into it, just this past spring, trying to analyze how the physics would work, just taking some basic, celestial mechanics, basic astrophysics assumptions, and plugging them in, the science, the physics, it's really scary, really kind of scary.
Well, I was going to say, if you look at Revelation and you try to interpret it and accept it as a very accurate guide of the future, you're right, Gil, it is very scary.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you started to look at Revelation and then look at wormwood, for example, how did you put the two and two together?
Well, again, wormwood, the problem is what caught my eye at first was wormwood does not mean wormy wood. In fact, it doesn't mean wood at all. The reference to wormwood is actually a reference in the Bible to an herb that was used in olden times to get rid of worms. It's called sweet artemisia. And if you've ever tasted sweet artemisia, it is not sweet. It is so foul, so raunchy, that if you can hold your cookies after you taste it, you're doing very good. But if you can get some internally, it'll chase any parasite you have out the other end of your, alimentary canal. And they go screaming for mercy because that stuff is really bad, really, really bad. So the thing about wormwood is more the fact that it's just so terribly, terribly foul tasting. And some translations refer to it as bitterness. They don't refer to it as wormwood. And what it was, the problem was that the Revelation describes the poisoning of the land so that the runoff water and the springs are so befouled by the asteroids and junk, space junk coming in. that what happens is it poisons the water supplies. And says a lot of men die because of it. They can't get decent water to drink. That's what caught my eye. The question was, what was it? And the star part kind of eluded me until you guys had Jason Rand on, and then we started looking at this brown dwarf issue. The brown dwarf issue just opened up, and it explains so many things. It solves so many problems.
Some of the other people who have talked about Planet X on this program, and I'm talking about way gone back, you know, I think some of the mistakes they made, they came up with specific targeted dates. It's very difficult to do that. And then when those dates came, Gilbert, you know, everybody jumped up and down and went, aha, you were wrong. Rather than to talk about the issue itself, and that is there an object out there? Is it going to come? And if it does, what is that going to do to us?
Well, the answer is yes, and it's not going to be very nice, and it's going to do some very, very bad things.
The Book of Revelation itself has hope at the end, but during the process as we go through it, it's not very good at all. It's not very pleasant. Did you interpret it that way as well?
Yeah, basically my approach to the book, how I was able to unlock a lot of these secrets was just a lot of very, very repetitious reading, forward, backward, sideways, you know, just over and over and over again, just digging and digging and digging relentlessly. After about the first 6 or 7 months, 8 months, I was ready to give up. And then just about the time I was ready to give up, I got my first insight in the book, and that was how the Antichrist comes into being. That's an interesting process all by itself. And very shortly after that, a lot of other insights began to flow as well. But the last stuff that fell into place was the Wormwood Science. And the Wormwood Science suddenly makes the revelation so clear. Because what you're talking about at the end of it all is the fulfillment, the physical fulfillment of prophecy. And the Revelation bookends itself as a prophecy, chapter 1 and chapter 22. So prophecy means that you've got to have a time-based unfolding inside Earth history time of something that was revealed before.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So when it actually, to be a prophecy, there's a requirement in the Bible that it be 100% accurate, that it be 100% fulfilled. So the revelation is a prophecy, which means it's going to happen. Like it or not, intention or not, wishful thinking or not, it's going to happen. It's a prophecy. And as it's started to unfold, it dawned on me that we really were in the end times. And rather than look at all of the stuff, especially the seals, as judgment events, the best way to look at it was giving you a map of the end times at the end, you know, pretty close.
Right.
And then it was going to give you insight into the judgments. So we're right there at the door in the end times. Then the judgments come after that.
See, and as they begin to find pieces of real things that the Bible talks about, writes about, all of a sudden, as you said, it makes it all seem real. It makes the whole thing unfold. And that's the fascinating point to me, because though we may not have the answers to everything that is in prophecy, the fact that you're beginning to see these items come up and it's accurate or it backs up, you've got to start saying, you know what, the whole thing could be true.
The whole thing is true. The only question was how to interpret. See, a lot of the revelation is symbolic, and some of it is very flowery in descriptions. Okay?
Right.
And when you get, as you start to wade through some of the descriptions, it's a little tough to try to sort through, you know, where's the flower and where's the, you know, the literal stuff. For example, the part that caught my eye and really started making me feel like we really have to get on coast to coast quickly was the pattern pressure as we analyzed the science. We had an interval starting in 2004 with a tsunami, and then the massive earthquakes in Peru, 2007, and the next window is right now, 2009. The problem is that the wormwood activities tend to center up along the summer-winter solstice line, the orbit of the Earth.
Yes.
You take that line and you extend it all the way out to Neptune on both sides, from the center of the sun out, and that's the line that wormwood comes in on.
And the Mayans knew this too.
they seem to. You know, it's just uncanny. They had insight that is just jolly inconvenient.
I just had a story tonight that scientists are beginning to believe now that that 1908 Tunguska-Siberia blast was probably caused by a comet that exploded high in the atmosphere. But the devastation on just where it was incredible. If that had hit today over an American city or any city on this planet, it would have been wiped out.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, Tunguska was very destructive. Extremely so.
Now, when you talk about these consecutive serial orders of events, tell me about that.
Well, the basic pattern pressure, as I was trying to sort this through, was that Wormwood had its greatest effect along the solstice line, summer and winter solstice. Like I say, you take that line from the center of the sun out through the summer solstice and just extend that out through the rest of the ecliptic plane on both sides, summer and winter. And what you get is a line that divides the ecliptic plane from the sun all the way out to Neptune on both ends of the orbit. It divides it into two parts. That line is the line that Wormwood comes in on, arcs up over the sun, mm-hmm. and goes back out on. It follows the solstice line produced.
What would astronomers say about something like that?
That depends on whether you're going to get an honest answer. You have to pay a little vigorous to get the truth. Remember, this is the kind of thing they wanted to suppress, George. They really don't want this information out. Okay?
Yeah, I don't want to believe that, but you may be right.
Okay, well, did you want to go over some of the evidence of the things we have to look for?
Yeah, let's do that. We've got all night, so go ahead.
Okay. Basically, what it comes down to, Wormwood is a brown dwarf star. It is the sun's binary companion, little mm-hmm. sister, if you will. About 80% of the stars in our sector of the galaxy are binaries. Now, flip that backwards the other direction. That would mean then that 80% of the there's an 80% chance that our sun would also be a binary instead
That's true.
Of being a yellow dwarf bachelor. It's not a bachelor. It's got a little sister, if you would. Okay. Wormwood, then, is this bachelor star, is the companion to the sun. And it is a brown dwarf, from the best that we can tell from the information that Dr. Rand was able to get, military sources, they think it's about the size of Saturn, possibly as large as Jupiter. Instead of being gas, it's an iron oxide ball, just a big giant iron ball. And it's really heavy.
Very dark, right?
Well, it'll be visible when it gets closer into the ecliptic plane, but it's very heavy. It does not give off visible light in the visible light part of the spectrum. It gives off light in the infrared spectrum because it's hot. It's probably volcanic. It throws massive amounts of iron oxide dust out, which are distributed in through the inner node rings. And because it is so heavy, at 60 times Jupiter's mass, it is about 1/17 of a solar mass.
Oh, my.
Which means Wormwood is the second heaviest body in the solar system next to the sun. It outweighs all the planets by a factor of many times over.
And these are objects that people who are tracking asteroids, for example, don't want to see. They don't want to see iron asteroids, for example. They want to see those made out of rock so they'll disintegrate and burn up.
Yes. But at 60 times Jupiter's mass and somewhere between the size of Saturn and Jupiter, this thing is heavy. Now, if we made the standard normal assumptions about how it would operate, the other thing that we were told was that it's coming in on a very elliptical orbit, and we will have... pages up that will show how the elliptical orbit works. We do have now on the website millenniumprophecy.com, we do have some stuff under the science section that shows the perihelion arc over. But eventually we're going to have, my son Jason will have some of the other pictures up showing the elliptical orbit. It has a highly elliptical orbit that is mostly on the southern hemisphere side of the ecliptic plane. Its transit time is about 1,800 years, plus or minus outbound and the same thing back. So it's about a round trip of 3,660 years.
Very exactly what Zechariah Sitchin had said about planet Nibiru.
Hi, Letty, but it's not a planet. This sucker is a brown dwarf star. Okay? This
and
thing
dangerous.
Is very heavy. Very heavy.
How close does it get to the planet, Gil?
If I've guessed this right, George, we're going to have another set of wake-up, shake-up calls here very shortly. And then May, June, July next year, in its perihelion walk through on this end of its orbit, it's going to get close enough to exchange atmospheric gases with the Earth.
Oh, my God. Now, does this thing act like a huge magnet as well because of its makeup?
It probably does, but that's not what causes the grief. What causes the grief is the fact that because it is so heavy, and it's most likely spinning because just about all objects in space are spinning one way or the other, stars and planets, this thing will spin too. Well, the way that that works, when an object has a very powerful baryonic field, it has a lot of mass, and you spin it, it develops node ring or distortion fields. They're like a series of concentric hula hoops. And these concentric hula hoops then are reflected back from the dark matter, dark energy of space, the dark soup, you know. And what you end up with are these concentric rings. Where those rings are around the sun, that's where the planets orbit. Where the rings are around the Earth, that's where the moons are. The same thing for Jupiter and Saturn. Where those node rings are, gravitational node rings, that's where the planets will have their moons and stuff. If you take a planet like Saturn and really rev it up fast, I mean, just let it really go, then the thing not only will generate node rings for moons, but lots of rings for ice and junk and all sorts of stuff. And the Cassini spacecraft got some excellent pictures. We have those on the website. Each one of the rings are spinning at a different speed, with the fastest ones on the inside and the slowest ones on the outside. So spinning bodies generate these gravitational distortions, and that's where planets orbit suns, moons orbit planets, and that's where the space junk and the asteroids orbit wormwood, because it can dislodge.
Oh, so yes. it's pulling all this stuff with it.
Everywhere it goes, anything that's within gravitational reach, it grabs on, and that becomes part of wormwood's extra goodies.
Now, this next event that you say is coming, are we talking about earthquakes, tsunami, getting hit by something? What is it?
Well, Wormwood still seems to be a little bit far out, but the Revelation described it this way. Chapter 6, 12 through 14, I looked, it broke the sixth seal. There was a great earthquake, number one. The sun became black as sackcloth made of hair, two. The whole moon became like blood, three. Verse 13, the stars of the sky fell to the earth, four. It's a fig tree when it casts unripe figs when shaken. The next one was the sky was split apart like a scroll when it's rolled up. And then the last one was every mountain and island were moved out of their places. So let's go over the list. Number one, a great earthquake. This is where the node rings of wormwood grab a hold of the earth and just shake the living liver out of it.
And these could be a series of earthquakes or just one big one?
Well, the first one that I think Earth personally experienced was December 2024, was it? Tsunami? 26 tsunamis?
Yes.
What date was it? 2004. December.
End of December, yeah.
Yeah, and that grabbed a hold of the plates down there by the island of Sumatra. When the quaking and the rolling started, it lasted for 10 minutes, continuous, without stopping.
Gilbert, let's talk more about these events when we come back. His website, millenniumprophecy.com. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Friday's a holiday, but we'll be here live for you right here on Coast to Coast AM. And when we come right back, more with our guest Gilbert Erickson on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Our guest tonight, Gilbert Erickson. Fascinating work, The Millennium Prophecy. Okay, Gilbert, we were talking about then the tsunami and the plates moving. And that, you're saying, is sign number one?
No, what I'm saying is that all of the seals have been broken except seal number six and seal number seven. When we read the description of the things that will happen with the breaking of seal number 6. And that's Revelation chapter 6, verses 12 through 14. It describes a list of events that when the seal is broken, you can expect this list to physically play out. Number one on the list was a great earthquake. Now remember, when Wormwood last hit the world, it hit the southern hemisphere with that undercutting action. And the island of Sumatra, the tectonic plate it was resting on, was shaking and quaking and rolling and bucking for 10 continuous minutes.
Yes.
That is not a normal earthquake where you have a fault line. It slips and the energy is released as the pressure is built up and released. 10 minutes of shake, rattle, and roll, something is wrong.
Something's not wrong.
An earthquake. That's another driver mechanism doing the shaking. Well, in this case, what I'm saying is that was Wormwood calling, hitting us with an outer node ring. All right, number two on the list, the sun became black as sackcloth made of hair. That refers to volcanic activity at the tectonic plate edges that finally blow off and blow high tonnages of volcanic ash and dust into the atmosphere. And it can actually darken the skies.
Could it be the Yellowstone caldera?
God, I hope not.
I know
it. If that does, the United States is toast. Okay, number three, the whole moon became like blood. This one gets real interesting because Wormwood has the ability to somehow grind or, you know, volcanically discharge its iron oxide dust into or above its atmosphere so that it gets picked up by its own gravitational node rings and distributed outward.
Which is red.
And it's got a red color to it. So when it says the whole moon became like blood, John was looking up, and as the intrusion of iron oxide dust occluded in the atmosphere, he looked at the moon, and it was silver, and then all of a sudden started turning, you know, iron oxide red. Okay, item number four, the stars of the sky fell to the earth. Okay, that can't be stars. It's got to be asteroids or
comets.
Space junk, meteorites, whatever. So you can expect some sort of demonstration of meteorite events, not meteorite, to the earth, actually making contact with the ground. Here's the hard part. This one is tough. Now, you mentioned Yellowstone, the caldera. The sky was split apart like a scroll when it is rolled up. I said, wait a minute, John, that's backwards. When it's rolled out. No. When it's rolled up. Okay, what's the sky split apart? If St. John was looking up, was near the cone of the crater, when this thing went off, the concussion of a pyroclastic explosion would feel like the sky was splitting apart.
Absolutely.
So what he was doing is he was seeing an event similar to Mount St. Helens or Mount Vesuvius. When Krakatoa blew its top back in the 1800s, the concussion could be heard 1,200 miles away. That's a lot of concussion.
That's huge.
So if St. John wrote the sky was split apart, he must have felt one massive concussion. Now, we better hope and pray that the Yellowstone caldera doesn't blow, because if it does, a priori, most of the United States is toast. But the United States is not the only place where something like this can happen. It could be anywhere. If the caldera blows at the northern end of New Zealand, for example, half of New Zealand blows away. So wherever this one is, he's calling, at least from the best that I can tell, he's referring to a pyroclastic explosion. Now, what about the scroll when it's rolled up? As he looked up in the sky and the ash plume blew toward the heavens, toward the sky, he noticed the mushroom cloud tucking. And so he used that picture as like a scroll when you roll it out and you let go.
Okay.
It springs back. And so it's like a scroll rolling back. It's rolling up. The problem is he was looking up at a mushroom cloud from underneath.
And he could only describe it in terms of things that he has seen
Exactly.
Items that he knows.
Exactly right. So what he was describing was probably a Mount St. Helens type, you know, blow-off, pyroclastic explosion. And when he looked up and saw the mushroom cloud, he used that descriptor. Now, when you think about it, that is a very, very accurate description. Feeling the concussion, feels like he's blown away.
Mm-hmm.
The sky was split apart.
Could he have been talking about some kind of nuclear bomb?
No. Okay. No, this is a pyroclastic explosion.
All right.
And the mushroom cloud is blowing off. Wormwood is pulling down and stressing on the crust of the Earth right now, so that you're getting a lot of earthquakes in strange places that haven't had them for very long times.
Okay.
And they're just blowing up. They're creaking. They're groaning. The whole crust of the Earth is under stress right now because this thing is pulling so hard. Item number six: every mountain and island were moved out of their places. That sounds like tectonic shifting to me.
Huge shifting.
Huge tectonic shifting. When Wormwood was finished pulling on the tectonic plates down there by Sumatra, and the bucking and the rolling was finished, the whole island of Sumatra was displaced, I think, something like about 110 feet. The tectonic plate actually slid that much. That's a lot of slide.
That's huge.
But then the tsunami kicked off, and we probably lost something like 250,000 people.
Jeez.
Okay, so the earthquake didn't do that much damage, but the tsunami was very deadly.
That did it all. That's right.
Okay, now, St. John does not mention tsunami events, but I think it's a reasonable thing to say that if you're going to get mountains and islands shifting around, there's got to be something hitting some coast somewhere.
Well, and you know, Gil, that the one in the Canary Islands,
mm-hmm.
if that thing goes, if that shifts into the sea, they're talking about a tsunami of 600 feet tall that would hit the eastern seaboard of the United States 50 miles inland, at least.
Mm-hmm. You want to hear something scary, scary, scary?
You mean scarier than that?
Scarier than that. Right. Wormwood is right on the axis, if you take the axis that the Earth is tilting at right now, 23.45 degrees. Wormwood lines up perfectly on that axis. It comes in on the summer solstice side, arches. It comes in between the center line of the orbit of Jupiter and the center line of the orbit of the asteroid belt, right up between Jupiter and the asteroids. It arcs up over the sun. It gets close enough to the Earth to actually exchange atmospheric gases and cause problems. We can talk about that in a minute. Arcs up over the sun and comes back down the other side and goes back down between the asteroid belt and Jupiter again. So the perihelion arc over is really up close and personal. Okay? When this thing is finished, it can slip and slide. This thing can turn the crust of the Earth right over on its side. If it makes the crust of the Earth shift 1 degree, you're going to be staring at 1,200-foot tsunamis.
Oh, my God.
Hang on. If it shifts the crust of the Earth 5 degrees, you will be staring at 3,000-foot tsunamis.
Which seems possible.
Because it's already twisted the Earth over on its side 23.5 degrees, exactly. This thing is largely responsible for where the Earth is sitting, its axis, angle of axis rotation, relative to, you know, the ecliptic plane. And it's also responsible for the tectonic shifting that has produced the picture of the continents and the islands and the oceans and all the rest of it that we have now.
And is it true, is it right to assume that almost every catastrophe, natural catastrophe, that has occurred on this planet, whether it's the flood from Noah's era, was caused by this Wormwood?
Well, it turns out that it lines up time-wise to the flood from Noah's era. It also lines up time-wise to the exodus of the children of Israel and their escape from Egypt. This people don't understand, but Wormwood is so strong that when it gets in up close and personal, it can reach right through the Earth, all the way through the Earth, and pull a continent down under the waves on one side of the Earth, and pull a continent up out of the waves on the other side of the Earth, and do it in 20 minutes.
Should we say Atlantis?
Does Atlantis ring a bell?
Yeah.
What about Lemuria?
Yeah.
They were there. Not anymore. Well, I mean, excuse me. I shouldn't say that. Not now. There's a very good chance that you're going to see Atlantis rising in 2012. That's Wormwood talking. Reaching down, it can actually distort the plastic mantle underneath the crust, make it bulge, so that it bulges up, and the sea rolls off the top, and there you've got dry land again.
Gilbert, let me ask you a strange question.
Go ahead.
And that is, do you think the pyramids. I heard this years ago, that the pyramids were put where they are as earthquake protectors, stabilizers. Do you think that they could have been built because they knew of this wormwood and they thought maybe these structures could protect that landmass or that area?
Boy, that's a good one.
That is a long, yeah, that, it's a long that, shot.
That's a real tough question. Right up front, to be honest, I haven't looked into the physics of that.
Okay.
To be sure, the pyramids are so very heavy. When the pyramid is being constructed, they have a bridge piece of stonework in there that actually cracked because of the settling from the weight. And they didn't know if they had to replace it or not, so they plastered it to see if the plaster would also chip, which would tell them whether I had to go back and put another stone in place because they had to adjust the positions. But there's so much we don't know about the pyramids. You had a guest on who was describing finding liquid mercury down by the pyramid here in Mexico, or Belize, I guess it is. Or is it Mexico, isn't it? Yucatan?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right about that area.
The Mayan pyramid.
Right in Central America.
Right. Okay. So there is some evidence that, you know, the pyramids may have been power supplies. It's also possible that they were operating on some extremely advanced principles, the kind of stuff that only a Nikola Tesla would know. You know, who really knows for sure? Whatever was happening, the Mayans were so far ahead of us on so many things and so far behind on others. But it was just, you know, this just some very strange and very intriguing architecture and technology that are tied up in the pyramids. I know there's one granite stone one of the authors was claiming. They went in and checked. It had been ground so fine, so accurate, that across a span of 6 feet, and he measured it with a very accurate ruler gauge that he had brought with him, across a span of 6 feet, it was accurate to less than a thousandth of an inch. Well, that's approaching the kind of microflat grinding that we use in the machine shop to do our gauge settings for tool and die work.
Good point.
Okay, I mean, that is really good. That is not the kind of stuff that you can, you know, grind by hand. Somebody knew what they were doing. And because the evidence tends to suggest the pyramids are a lot older than, you know, what we think they are, my apologies to, you know, Mr. Hawass, there may be, you know, there's got to be a lot of stuff tied up in the pyramids, the technology. It does tend to suggest that somebody like Enoch or somebody of his caliber was involved in building them, because there's just too much technique and technology involved.
I don't want to hit you up with a timeline, but I'm going to have to, because these events are so frightening, and if prophecy and revelation is accurate, and I'm beginning to believe it is, there's a schedule there, and it's laid out for us. Over what time period will all these things occur? 7 years?
Well, that's the tribulation period. And George, I have to preface this. You know, personally, to be real honest, I don't want this to be true.
I know you don't.
I mean, I got, you know, a 3-foot grandson. I'd like to see what he looks like when he's 6 feet. I'd like to see what the granddaughters look like when they're, you know, 16, 17, 18.
I hear
you. You know, find out what's going on in their lives. You know, I don't want the destruction of civilization to happen, right? It's jolly inconvenient. But I would be remiss as an investigator if I didn't try to get your attention or Lisa or somebody and try to get this information out, just in case it is true. But the hard part of the problem for me is that it does look like it is true and that it's coming true on this timeline. So we just described the summer of 2009 events. If this is confirmed within the next few weeks or so, and again, hopefully not, but you know, the only thing I can do is just cross my fingers, because that's a nasty list that we just read.
Oh, and now, will they all occur in the summer of this year?
Yes. All right. If this is true, in other words, if I've guessed this correctly, and I'm guessing, but it looks like that's the period pressure. Okay.
But what if you're a year off? What if it happens next year? My God, it's still horrible.
It's still a very horrible thing. Then all you do is you just take the same schedule that I have proposed in the book and slide it back a year. We get a year's reprieve.
All right, let me ask you this. If you're wrong in terms of the timing, why would you be wrong?
Don't know.
And you don't think you are wrong.
It is for something I can't, you know, that I must have forgotten or that I don't know. But I'm just hoping that there's something, that there's a hole I've missed.
All right, let me rephrase
it. And I don't want it to be true, but it does look like it is.
Why do you think it's happening in the summer of 2009?
Okay, the pattern pressure that I was looking at, it started in 1821 with the discovery that the orbit of Uranus was a full degree deflected from where it should have been. Now, keep in mind, at the time, the scientists were, they had developed the math, you know, the calculus,
yes,
complements of Leibniz and those people, so they can pretty well, you know, tell where things should have ought to been. But a 1 degree deflection as measured from planet Earth, even though the telescopes of the day could only measure accurately to 1/10 of a degree, a 1 degree deflection,
that's
was
huge.
10 times measurable error. So Alexis Bouvard found out when he was looking at Uranus, he said, you know what, this thing is supposed to be over here, but instead it's over there. And what you have then is physical evidence pointing to something pulling on it. Well, Mary Somerville, a very brilliant English mathematician who wasn't allowed to be part of the university system because she was a lady. They didn't mind reading her books, but they wouldn't let her go to school.
And give her credit for it.
Yeah, she suggested there'd be another planet out there behind Uranus. And she was correct. John Couch Adams discovered, or did the math, and gave it to George Airy at the Royal Observatory, and he sat on it. A year later, Urbain Le Verrier did the same kind of calculations and gave the sent the stuff by mail to Johann Gall at the Berlin Observatory, and that night they discovered Neptune.
Ah, okay.
Now, that was true that you had a way to account for Uranus, except for one slight problem, and that was Neptune was also running under a perturbed orbit. Now, this is where the term Planet X came from, because you had planets out to Neptune, and Planet X was whatever it was that was pulling on Neptune and causing it to be deflected in its orbit.
Was Planet X, Wormwood, was it out that way somewhere?
Planet X, Wormwood, comes from up underneath. It's a long elliptic orbit. It comes up from underneath, cuts through the ecliptic plane, again, between Jupiter and the asteroid belt.
Okay.
Arcs up over the sun and goes back down through the ecliptic plane and then back out to deep space. So it was pulling on them from down below. But
okay,
it was pulling on them on the summer solstice side.
How close did it have to get to create that pull, Gil?
It has been pulling since 1821, that
so
we know of.
Almost 200 years.
Yes. Figure the sun has a gravitational reach that goes out, oh boy, half a light year.
Okay.
Its ability to generate node rings goes out to about 4.5 light hours. Okay, the radius of the orbit of Neptune. So its ability, its gravitational reach is way beyond its ability to generate node rings. So the same would be true for Wormwood. Its gravitational reach was beyond the node rings by a whopping factor, enough to be able to pull on a gas giant and dislodge it from orbit.
Gil, when we come back, let's find out what does NASA know and why aren't we being told? We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.